Good morning and welcome to the Thursday, February 27th, 2025 meeting of the Minnesota House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. We have a couple of administrative things we'll take care of here this morning. And the first is to review and approve the minutes from February 25th. And Representative Elkins, have you had a chance to review those, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I will move their approval.
Representative Elkins moves the approval of the minutes from February 25th. Any questions? Hearing none, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The primary purpose for today's meeting is to continue to follow up on discussions as we have been on inputs for and drivers for cost of insurance premiums. And one of the topics that we've had before us, a number of bills have been introduced dealing with mandates, insurance, health insurance mandates. And we've also had a number of those over the last couple of years. And so we have the opportunity this year, because we meet more often than we have in the past, to do a deeper dive into these topics. And so with that this morning, we have Ashley Seidel from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, who's going to get us started and talk with that process. And I welcome you this morning to the committee. And if you will go ahead and state your name and then proceed with your testimony. Good morning. Great. And welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. My name is Ashley Seidel, and I'm the Health Policy Director in the Insurance Division at the Department of Commerce. Thank you all for inviting us to come back and continue the conversation that started last week. So we're going to walk through the full sort of health benefit mandate evaluation process. I know some of this will be really familiar to all of you, but we'll start with just a little bit of a background and refresher. So states have been passing state mandated benefit laws for decades to help define the benefit packages required in their states. I yesterday saw a GAO report from 1996 looking at this exact issue that said that states had passed on average 18 benefit mandate laws, and that ranged from, I think, 6 in Idaho to 39 in Maryland, and Minnesota was, I think, had 34 passed. But that was really in the pre-ACA world, and the ACA really changed things when it came to benefit design because it created this concept of essential health benefit packages and required states to set an essential health benefit benchmark plan in their state that covered these 10 essential health benefits. And so many of the state mandates that had been passed in the decades prior to the ACA were for benefits that ultimately became required essential health benefits. The ACA also said that states could continue to pass state mandates above and beyond what's in their essential health benefit benchmark plan, but if they do so for the individual market, they need to defray the cost of those benefits to health issuers. And so after that law took effect, over the next about 10 years or so, Minnesota only passed one benefit mandate that by the federal requirements exceeded the state's essential health benefit coverage and required defrayal. And that was for PANS PANDAS, a behavioral health benefit for children that was passed in 2019. And as under the health benefit evaluation process, as it's been working for the last 4 years, Commerce makes the determination of whether a benefit that we're studying exceeds the EHB package as part of that process. So this slide lays out the definition of a mandated health benefit proposal under the state statute. So Commerce is required to conduct 62J evaluations on benefits that meet any of the conditions laid out on this slide. So provides or increases coverage for the treatment of a disease or condition, provides coverage for care delivered by a certain type of provider, requires certain types of cost sharing, and you can see the others on this slide. I think it's helpful to flag that the sort of the state definition of a mandated health benefit proposal is more expansive than the federal definition. The federal definition really focuses on bills that require specific care, treatment, or services for enrollees, and so that's really sort of the first two bullets on this slide. But things like bills that change cost sharing, things like that, aren't considered mandates under the federal rules post-ACA. So the state mandates only apply to state-regulated insurance products. So that's typically about 18% of Minnesotans and includes about 187,000 individuals enrolled in the individual market, about 210,000 enrolled in the small group market, and about 670,000 enrolled in the fully insured large group market. And then depending on the bill, they can also apply to Medicare supplement plans, CGIP, and Minnesota healthcare programs, but they never apply to traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage, or self-insured employer plans.
Mrs. Pollard, can you go back to that previous slide? I just want to clarify something for members.
Mm-hmm.
In the second bullet point where you, underneath where it says typically applies to 18%, 187,000 individuals, is that policies or is that persons covered under plans? For example, I might purchase a policy. I'm an individual. I might purchase a policy that covers my family. How is that distinguished with the small group and then with the larger groups? Is that persons covered or is that policies issued?
I believe that's enrollees. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things around costs and the way that we think about costs of state mandated benefits. So the first is the defrayal cost. And so, you know, at Commerce, when we talk about defrayal costs, we are typically talking about the amount that the state has to directly pay health plans annually to defray the cost of a state mandated benefit that was determined to be in addition to the state's essential health benefit plan. And when we think about defrayal and making that assessment of which benefits are sort of above and beyond EHB, we think about full and partial defrayal. So a benefit that would require full defrayal is something that's really new. Like, I think a good example of that is a couple years ago we evaluated acupuncture, and that is clearly excluded from the state's benchmark plan currently. So if a bill covering acupuncture passed, we would need to defray the whole cost. Partial defrayal can come into play when there's a bill that covers a number of different services, and some of them we know are included in the benchmark plan, but some are not. And this happened last session when we passed the prosthetics and orthotics bill, because the benchmark plan covers sort of standard prosthetics and orthotics for individuals, but the bill also covered prosthetics for things like bathing, separate prosthetics for recreational devices, things like that, and those were not broadly covered in the benchmark plan, and so the cost of those needs to be defrayed. So that the defrayal costs are sort of direct costs to the state. And then the PMPM cost is not a direct cost to the state, but here we think about the broader estimated impact of covering an additional benefit on health insurance premiums. And mandates can increase PMPM costs for a variety of reasons. It can be increased utilization if there's either a brand new benefit or even, you know, I think we often think that if we are codifying something that is already covered and just clarifying that it's covered, that can also increase utilization because patients and providers are potentially more aware that it's a covered benefit. Mandates also sometimes reduce cost sharing or prohibit utilization management strategies, which can also impact PMPM costs. And then we also know that medical costs are always increasing. So, you know, even if a benefit is covered today, you know, 1 year from now, it might be a little bit more expensive because that's just sort of the way that things go. So those are the PMPM costs. And then a little bit about the evaluation process. So I think everyone is familiar that Commerce evaluates the potential impacts of legislative proposals that add or increase coverage for certain conditions, diseases, or other health needs. We work with a vendor, American Institutes for Research, on those evaluations and also work really closely with MDH and MMB. In terms of the process, legislators submit requests for mandate evaluations by August 1st, and then the House and Senate Commerce chairs prioritize those requests based on the number of mandates submitted, the capacity of the research team to complete the, you know, volume of requests within the time frame, and the relative difficulty of the evaluations. And then the evaluations are due 180 days from the date of request to the legislature. So when we get a bill for evaluation, the first thing that we really do is a feasibility assessment. So we, you know, review the language to really understand what the bill is doing, and then review all of the available quantitative and qualitative data that's available to help us understand what sort of scope of evaluation we can reliably produce with that data. So if we produce a full evaluation, that typically includes a quantitative analysis in partnership with MDH using their all-payer claims database, a qualitative literature review, a public comment period through a request for information, and then a defrayal assessment and calculation if it's determined that a benefit requires defrayal. So once we have sort of the scope of each evaluation defined, then we start working on producing the actual evaluation. So we post a request for information to get information from the public. We get often comments from various advocacy or patient or provider groups. We typically get PMPM estimates from issuers through this process, and then we also get information from MMB about the fiscal and coverage impacts to CGIP through this process. We also have started conducting interviews with the submitting member of the bill to better understand the context behind the development and the sort of the need that the bill is filling. We'll do the public health and economic literature review and the claims analysis, and then, as I said, also the defrayal analysis and calculation if needed. Some of the challenges that we often face with producing the evaluations are data limitations. So particularly the last couple of years, we've been asked to evaluate mandates that are very new treatments, like gene, you know, last year or this year we did a gene therapy evaluation that was approved by the FDA, you know, only months ago, and so we don't have the claims data or didn't have the claims data to produce a quantitative analysis yet. We also are only able to use data that's available in the APCD. So, you know, a couple years ago we did a dental evaluation and there are no dental claims in the APCD at this point, and so we weren't able to do an evaluation or quantitative evaluation of that benefit. Also, we sometimes receive mandates that have bill language that's relatively broad, and that, you know, either it covers a number of different conditions or a number of, you know, different services, or, you know, like all approved drugs. You know, they're just relatively broad, and to conduct an actuarial analysis, we need to sort of scope things down a little bit and make some assumptions about to be able to do an analysis. And we can do that, but then it also means that we may be sort of limiting the generalizability or the accuracy of the findings and may potentially be understating sort of the findings. Additionally, sometimes the bill language changes, so we sort of have to run with what we get in August because there are a lot of steps that go into this process, and it usually takes us the full 180 days, particularly when we're doing multiple evaluations at a time. And so when the bill language changes either over the evaluation process or during session, that also just typically means that sort of the study design may not reflect the latest version of the bill and, again, could potentially impact the sort of the applicability of the findings. And then the other thing is that, you know, some of the mandates that we've studied have potential downstream cost savings. You know, I think last year we studied GLP-1s for obesity treatment, and I think that's, you know, a lot of people's hope is that there are downstream savings from those, but trying to assess those is out of the scope of the project. So we look at the cost, but not any potential downstream savings. In terms of the numbers, so since 2021, we have completed 34 benefit mandate evaluations. 26 of those were mandates that create requirements for issuers to cover specific care, treatment, or services. And that's important because I sort of mentioned that the federal, that's sort of the federal definition of a state mandated benefit. So 26 of those could have potentially, you know, qualified as a mandate under the federal rules. 11 were determined to require defrayal under the federal ACA rules. Five of those would have required full defrayal, and six were partial. Two this year, we were actually unable to determine whether partial defrayal was required, and that was because the bills covered a sort of a broad array of services, and we knew that some of them were certainly included under the benchmark plan, but there were so many that we couldn't. It's possible that some were not and could require partial defrayal, but we just weren't able to. There's not enough detail in the benchmark plan to be able to sort of make that assessment. Four bills that require defrayal have passed since the mandate review process was established in its current form in 2021. And then nine additional bills that were evaluated but did not require defrayal have passed. We also have started doing retrospective evaluations. So in 2023, the legislature directed Commerce to complete one retrospective evaluation each year. Through 2028. And so last year we looked at 62A30 subdivision 4, which provides coverage for 3D mammogram screening for individuals at high risk of breast cancer. So that evaluation is available on our website. And then we are also hard at work on our next retrospective evaluation, which is looking at coverage of chiropractic care, and will be published at the end of March. This is just a summary of the findings from our 2024 mandate evaluations. So we looked at nine benefits and released all of the reports at the end of January. So as you can see, we've listed the mandates that we studied, whether they required defrayal or not. This year, there was only one that required defrayal and included that year one defrayal estimate for that benefit. We also included the PMPM estimates that we calculated for those that we were able to do an actuarial analysis for, and then included the issuer PMPMs that we received through the public comment period. And then a little bit about existing health benefit mandates. So as I mentioned, of the 34 that we've evaluated since 2021, 13 of them have passed. And so this slide shows the six that have passed in either 2021 or 2022. So you can see which those are on the slide. There was one coverage of biomarker testing that met the ACA's definition for a mandate that required defrayal that took effect this year. And so those payments will start next year. And then we also included the PMPM estimates that were calculated in our analyses. And then this slide lays out the seven mandates that passed, that were evaluated in 2023 and passed in last year's session. There were three that required defrayal, two partial and one full. So we've included those initial estimates from our reports, and then again, the PMPM estimates that were calculated in our reports. Just a little bit about the defrayal payment process. So every year after the plan year closes, carriers submit their actual claims experience for the prior year for that benefit to us for defrayal. We currently reimburse based on the claims paid for that benefit in the prior year. And so as I mentioned, right now we are only currently making defrayal payments on one benefit, the PANS PANDAS. And so that benefit took effect on January 1st, 2020, and we've made just under $140,000 in defrayal payments since then. And you can see the first plan year, we didn't receive any requests. And then we've sort of slowly increased to two requests in the 2023 plan year. We will be submitting instructions to carriers to submit 2024 reimbursement requests in the next couple of months. I'll say, I think this point was made last week, that the this benefit is pretty specialized, and so utilization is pretty low. I think we anticipate that payments may be higher for some of the other benefits that took effect this year. And so those are listed out on this slide. So there are four additional benefits that became effective on January 1, 2025. And we will start making defrayal payments for those next spring in 2026. And so this will be the first time that we make defrayal payments for a mandate that we also evaluated and produced an estimated cost for. So we will certainly be closely looking to see how the sort of year one experience matches up with what we projected. And we can see how those compare. And that's our overview for today.
Thank you, Ms. Santala. Questions for the presenter? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a question for the presenter? Is the essential health benefit package itself reevaluated from time to time? One, and then is there a way that legislators, you know, working on bills that have been brought to us by a patient group, whether we can tell any way for us to know in advance what's the kind of the standard of care, or what the essential health benefit related to that is at present?
Dr. Santala.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Elkins, thank you. So to the first question, CMS does have a process for updating the essential health benefit benchmark plans. My understanding is that it was sometimes lengthy and challenging process, and so not a lot of states had sort of gone through it, but they have made changes in recent years to try and streamline the process a little bit. Minnesota has never updated our plan, but it is something that we are actively exploring doing. And there are quite a few federal requirements about how you go about doing that and the types of analyses that need to be completed and how much sort of flexibility you have to add benefits. And a public comment period is also required.
Representative Elkins, follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Is the process, our mandate review process, does that provide the information that CMS would require in order to consider an expansion or change to the essential health benefit package at their level?
Ms. Atala.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Elkins. So I think that some of that information, I think we'll certainly, we would be interested in looking at some of those benefits and evaluating whether it makes sense to add them to the benchmark plan. A separate actuarial analysis is required. So I think that the a new analysis would need to be done, but I think our vendor would certainly find the work that's been completed so far to be useful.
And then, yeah, Representative Elkins. We do have other members that want to speak.
I know.
Go ahead, Representative Elkins.
I was the original author of this bill, so.
Understood.
If it needs to be fixed, I'd like to know how it should be fixed. So, and so last question I'll ask you is are there changes to the our legislation around this that could be made in order to align our mandate review process with the CMS process for updating the benefit package?
Director O'Driscoll.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Elkins. That's a great question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but we could certainly go back and think about that. The requirements are fairly complex, so we're still digesting and learning about them ourselves, but we could certainly think about whether there are changes.
All
right,
that could
be made to make it easier.
And Representative Elkins, thank you for, you know, helping us to get a process in place to do the reviews. We're now in process improvement, hopefully, from the work that you've done. So, again, thank you for that. Our next question comes from Representative Van Binsberg, Bergen, and then followed by Lead Her. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in regards to your evaluation. I've been getting a lot of calls and emails about chiropractic care. And I see there's an evaluation going on, and I'm just curious if you can give a little more of an update on that, and what's kind of the timing of, you know, when will we have some of your recommendations?
Dr. Satala.
Sure, Chair O'Driscoll, Representative. Yes, so we are actively working on the evaluation. It is due to the legislature, I believe, March 31st, maybe give or take a couple of days. So we will be publishing it soon. It will include, sort of similar to our proposed evaluations, a literature review of the public health and economic impacts of chiropractic care. We did a public request for information, and we actually received quite a few stakeholder comments, and so we'll include a summary of that. And then we also, our team works closely with MDH on an analysis of chiropractic care utilization using the all payer claims database. So I haven't seen the full findings yet, so I'm not entirely sure what all the analysis will include at this point.
Representative Vinsberg, in follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the chiropractic care, you say stakeholders, is the chiropractic care community involved in that?
Yes. We did receive comments from a number of independent chiropractors as well as the Minnesota Chiropractic Care Association.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair. Just to maybe help me understand this a little bit, because I often hear, insurers coming to me saying that mandates cost money, but I want to understand the difference between when they say it cost them versus like when we're looking at this deferral process in which we're saying there is a cost. Can you just maybe help me understand a little bit about the maybe my own disconnect around mandate costs in general and then the deferral process and what that is covering, or if it's the same thing, and maybe I'm just not understanding when people are coming to me saying there's a cost. But clearly some of these things are saying there's no deferral that is required.
Director Santala.
Mm-hmm. Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Herr. Sure. So so the deferral costs are not costs to health plans. They're a cost or a payment that's made from the state to the plans to help offset some of the cost of covering that additional coverage in the individual market. I think when plans say that mandates are increasing costs, I think they're talking about the PMPM cost, because when additional benefits are covered, as I sort of mentioned, utilization can increase. Sometimes mandates change cost sharing levels, and so plans, if you eliminate cost sharing on a benefit, then the plan pays for the full cost of the benefit, and so all of those costs that are calculated into their premiums, and so that, on the individual market for those benefits that we're defraying, we're sort of helping to mitigate that premium increase, but for the other markets and for the bills where we aren't making deferral payments, there can be those cost increases that get incorporated into premiums.
Representative Herr, follow-up. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at the amount, and thank you for your testimony. I appreciate the information. I'm looking at, on page 18, just the list of deferral estimates, and what it causes me to wonder is how we bring that information into our budgeting for future years, how those play into the money that we have available. Thank you.
Director Zatala.
Sure. Chair O'Driscoll,
yes.
Morning, Deputy Commissioner Dreyer. So the PANS, and Representative Breyer, the PANS PANDAS is an open appropriation in our bill. The other deferrals, we have an estimated amount included in our budget.
Representative Breyer, follow up. All right. Thank you for your testimony today. That ends members' questions. If you can just stand by in case there are follow-up questions, it would be much appreciated. Our next presenters are going to come from the Minnesota Department of Health, and we've got Stefan Gilmeister and Pam Mink, who are going to talk to us again about some of the other economic impacts of mandates. And they will be co-presenting this morning, and I believe they also have a handout that is available in your packet that will correspond to the slideshow that they are going to be using here today as well. And as they get set up, I will welcome them to the committee and appreciate them being here. And when you are ready, proceed with your testimony. I simply would ask you to identify yourself for the record before you begin with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the health economics program in the Department of Health, and I am the state health economist. With me today is Dr. Pam Mink, who leads our collaboration with the Commerce Department on the mandate benefit analysis. She also leads our researchers in the use of the Minnesota All-Payer Claims Database, which you've heard about some and which you will hear more about today. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting us to speak to the committee this morning. Quickly, a few words of who we are. The Health Economics Program conducts research and applied policy analysis focusing on monitoring changes in the healthcare market. We're seeking to help you understand factors that influence cost, quality, and access to healthcare and health insurance coverage. And our work is really based on objective, empirical analysis of data to give you solid, you and the public, solid technical assistance as you do your health policy work. As I said, our data's our work is data-driven, and you will see our work in chart books, in reports, and in presentations. What we were asked to do this morning is to talk a little bit about our collaboration with the Commerce Department on the mandate review, but I want to take a step back, Mr. Chair, and answer a question that came up a week ago about sort of what does the market look like and how do legislative requirements sort of flow through the market. When we think about health policy intended to be transformational in the state in that it changes perhaps market rules or payment policies or public health investments, we sort of think about the critical mass, because I think it was Representative Elkins last week who said there's the potential for policies in some markets to flow through other markets, and this is sort of the notion of the critical mass. The graph that I depict, which I hope you can see, sort of separates Minnesota's populations into two categories. Green on the left-hand side for individuals who have coverage that is sort of not under the state jurisdiction, and blue where state policies impact the health policy settings in which individuals obtain coverage. Sort of a summary, about 52% of the population have coverage that roughly falls under the jurisdiction of the Minnesota legislature. But there are some nuances because, of course, federal policies and rules around the ACA and around public program coverage still affect many of these market spaces. Just really quickly, on the right-hand side and under the jurisdiction, so to speak, of the state legislature, are non-ERISA self-insured populations like state and local government, for example. So this would include CGIP and PEEP. The Minnesota healthcare programs are Medicaid and Minnesota Care. Again, to remember, the federal government has rules around what can or cannot happen in Medicaid. And then further down on the slide, you see the fully insured market composed of the individual market, the small group market, and the large group market. These are market spaces where the employer or the individual purchases a policy. The risk, the insurance risk, rests with a health plan. And so this is calibrated against 5.7 million people, so you have about 200 individuals in the small group market and 160 or so thousand individuals in the individual market purchasing coverage on their own. And then about 3.8% of the population currently are uninsured in Minnesota, one of the smallest shares in the country. Then on the left-hand side, you have the significant self-insured market where the employer typically bears the risk, the health insurance risk. These are jumbo and large firms protected by federal law to not be subject to state policies. And then Medicare, both fee-for-service and Medicare Advantage, largely governed under federal rules.
Mr. Gildemeister, before we move on, I have just a clarifying question. I see that the note reference here talks about this is information that you've compiled from a number of different sources. What era is this? Is this as of 24, 23? What are we looking at here on this graph?
Ah, good question. Operator error. This is 2023 data. So pretty much the most recent information available as these data flow through from the government, from the prison system, from our insurance survey that we conduct every 2 years. But we've also seen these numbers to be fairly steady over the last few years. So they are, I think, a good reflection of the critical mass in the state. But thank you for asking that question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gildemeister, if that's 2023 data, do you happen to have data that you can share with the committee on what this breakdown might have looked at, say, from 2022, 2021, 2020? And the reason I see Representative Elkins, who's another data wonk like myself, shaking his head on this, and the reason I ask that question is I'm concerned that as the insurance premium rise, did the individual market of persons shrink and that uninsured market increase? And so at what rate was that as we contemplate what to do with reinsurance in the state of Minnesota and what to do with future mandates as this committee contemplates its work? If you can just get that to us offline, that would be helpful, but I think that's important data that we should be looking at the same time that we're having this conversation in a more global sense. Continue with your testimony, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we're happy to provide that information. And at this point, I am passing the baton on to Dr. Mink.
And again, good morning and welcome. If you'll go ahead and state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure, good morning. My name is Pamela Mink. I'm Director of Health Services Research at the Minnesota Department of Health. And good morning and thank you. I'm going to talk about MDH's role in the mandated benefits evaluations. I think my first slide here really actually covered most of this information, I think the important part here is that the evaluations focus on the potential fiscal, economic, and public health impacts of the proposed legislation, and we contribute to the evaluations as such. So this shows our basic process with MDH and working with Commerce and their contractor team from the American Institutes of Research. We really start after the bills have been sent to Commerce, and we go through each bill and discuss the scope of the evaluation. As Ashley mentioned, some are well suited for an actuarial evaluation, some are not. We consider those questions. We look to see if the Minnesota All-Payer Claims Database has data to offer to help contribute to the evaluations. And then we also, within MDH, identify some subject matter experts, depending on the topic of the bill, who can contribute to the public health evaluation. The next step for the bills that kind of move on that MDH and the Minnesota All-Payer Claims Database in particular contribute data to really define and refine the analytic approach and data needs. So during this step, we consider who's eligible for these benefits. Is it based on a particular disease diagnosis? Is it based on a particular age? And then we determine which diagnostic codes go along with that, as well as what procedure codes, or in the case of medications, the drug codes that go along with it. We consider what years of data are relevant and that we have. And then any limitations or caveats. And as Ashley mentioned, sometimes the limitations have to do with it's a very recent service or drug or procedure. And sometimes the limitations are it's a topic that isn't well captured through healthcare claims. So for example, I think this last year there was a bill about over-the-counter contraceptives. And since those transactions happen outside the health insurance claims, we don't get, we don't have information to contribute to that. So after we've had sort of those scoping conversations, we move on and we do analysis using the Minnesota All Payer Claims database for each of the bills that we contribute to. And so we create and produce aggregated data that contributes to the actuarial analysis. So again, looking at prevalence of conditions that make people eligible for the benefit, utilization patterns, as well as the paid amounts, the plan paid amounts, and the patient share for each service, sort of a unit cost for certain services or medications, and then also sort of a per member to understand if it's something that they do, you know, frequently throughout the year to get a sense of kind of what the utilization patterns are. And then finally, you know, those data go back to the actuaries and to Commerce, and then once the evaluations are drafted, then we go through and read them and offer comments and input and occasionally clarifications. And also connect back with the subject matter experts as appropriate. And I think Ashley shared a lot of these bills. What you see here are the plate of bills for each cycle that we've done, four cycles to date, and then in bold you can see the ones that the Minnesota All Payer Claims Database contributed data to. And so it just ranges across a very wide a wide range of bills and topics, and then you can see some that that we did not contribute to for various reasons.
Ms. Mink, before we move on to the next slide, and this may be something that Commerce could help us with, on this list of mandates that are on here, is there a way, and again, it doesn't have to be this morning, but something for the committee's reference, how many of these mandates that are on this page already had coverage, but we've moved from a baseline coverage in the policies up to an enhanced on that. Just kind of curious to see if it's from 0 to 100 or we already have 50% and now we're moving from 50 to 100% by enhancing coverage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that might be for Commerce, for Commerce, but they're here.
And if I just hold on 1 second, if Commerce caught that, I won't have you come back up and see us. If I can get a head nod from you that that's something that you have data. Pardon the interruption, but I wasn't sure who to ask that question to, and that's why I waited till later. If I could just get Ms. Santala to help us a little bit with that. Don't need to have the item-by-item breakdown for me this morning, but there's some follow-up information that can be mailed to the committee that would be very helpful.
Sure,
Ms. Santala.
Chair O'Driscoll, I think we could definitely provide that in follow-up. I think I would say generally bills where we determined that defrayal is required are ones that are new coverage and ones where we determined that their defrayal was not required. It's generally more of a sort of a clarification of coverage that's already provided, but I think we could just take a quick closer look at the bills and confirm that's sort of the case for all of them and send that in follow-up.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And again, pardon the interruption to our current presenters and testifiers. Ms. Mink, as you were, go ahead with your testimony.
Since I've been talking about the data that we use coming from the Minnesota All Payer Claims Database, I wanted to, for people who might be less familiar with it, to just tell you a little bit about that resource we have at the Minnesota Department of Health. So the Minnesota All Payer Claims Database it's a large data system. It collects and integrates data from the process of paying for health care. So a health service is provided or a prescription is filled. A claim is generated, the insurance pays back to the provider, and it's the record of those payments that gets sent to the Minnesota All Payer Claims Database. So we have information on enrollment. It includes medical claims, pharmacy claims. Ashley mentioned earlier that we didn't contribute data to a previous bill on because it was about dental coverage, but we are in the process of beginning to collect dental claims, so that's coming soon in the future. So what's in the Minnesota All Payer Claims database, it's all de-identified information. There are no personal identifiers in there, but information that allow us to look at diagnosed conditions, types of treatments or procedures or medications, surgeries, encounters, visits. It's information about the provider who provided that care, their specialty or classification, where the service took place. And then it has the actual transaction prices. So it's the adjudicated claims, the amount the plan paid and the amount the patient was responsible for. And then we have limited information about the people whose claims these are, but including age, gender, and five-digit zip code, which permits us to look at some geographic variation in there. Our data right now, we have complete years up through 2023 for commercial claims, which is what we use for the mandated benefits analysis, as well as for Minnesota healthcare programs. And then Medicare data lags a little bit behind that. So these data permit us to do a number of kinds of evaluations and analyses and reports and issue briefs. And these are kind of some of the broad categories that the research falls into. So studies of healthcare spending and spending patterns, system efficiency and waste, healthcare quality, epidemiology, healthcare markets, and public health. And on the next slide, I'll show you, just describe a couple of those specific examples. We recently completed a very large legislatively directed study on telehealth expansion and payment parity that used data from the Minnesota All Payer Claims database as well as from other sources, and that included an actuarial evaluation of the impact of telehealth expansion on healthcare costs. We also do now a regular report on healthcare spending, prices, and utilization patterns in Minnesota, and that one was recently released in the fall. We've contributed data to the RAND Hospital Price Transparency Study so that it has richer, the most recent cycle that they did has richer data for Minnesota than in the past. And then we've also worked with our partners across the agency on understanding sickle cell disease and sickle cell trait in Minnesota, so at one of the many data sources that they're drawing on. And then in progress coming soon, we are another legislatively directed report on non-claims-based payments and primary care, and also coming soon, a study of low-value healthcare services. That's another legislatively directed study. We also have work in progress to develop some drivers of healthcare cost dashboards that will be used for the new Center for Healthcare Affordability, as well as the Health Economics Program. And then we're also doing some analyses looking at out-of-pocket healthcare spending. So when you think about healthcare prices going up, what's the impact on Minnesotans in terms of what they're paying out of pocket? And then send it back to Stefan for the final slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to conclude with a few thoughts on the discussion you had last week about a sort of potential for ongoing work or looking back in time, creating cumulative understanding of the cost of mandates. And I think I recall Deputy Commissioner Dreyer saying, it's really hard to do this kind of work just on form filings by insurance carriers. It typically is resource-intensive and time-intensive work. It requires specialized actuarial and clinical experience to sort of ask the kind of questions you are asking. What is the marginal impact of changing a benefit set or changing cost-sharing? It also requires really solid data on health benefits so we can answer questions like what is the additional change in healthcare benefits and how will patients use it. The health department, as part of our health reform simulation over the past, has done some of that analysis with vendors. And I should say, this has been 20 years ago, so it's been quite a while. And the findings, I think, generally probably are no longer applicable for just because the market has changed, the benefit, the essential benefits system has changed the dynamics in the market. The cost of healthcare services have changed, and also the standards of care have changed. But there are two things I wanted to point out from that work. First of all, I mean, this work can be done sort of with the disclaimer that it's complicated and probably costly. But secondly, what was interesting in the study when I looked back at it was that the experts concluded at the time that 88% of those mandates, so these are mandates through the early 2000s, were likely covered voluntarily by health plans and employers choosing to adopt changes to the benefit set or changes to standards of care to deliver good services to their employees or to their enrollees in health benefits. I think secondly, you've talked a good amount about benefits and mandates and the cost of mandates to rising insurance premiums, a really important question, but I would also sort of encourage you to remember that healthcare premiums rise in part, significant part, because of the cost of care. And our analysis that Dr. Mink just referred to on the commercial market sort of has systematically shown that healthcare spending increases because of the price of healthcare increasing. So while the mandates account for a percentage point increase in the premiums, what is driving healthcare premiums, healthcare spending, and decisions, as you pointed out, Mr. Chair, on whether or not to take up coverage is the rising cost of healthcare for things like prescription drugs, including life-saving therapies, hospital care, long-term care, et cetera. So it's important to keep that in mind. I also wanted to conclude, and Dr. Mink said that in her analysis, by sort of recognizing that the health department is required to establish the Center for Healthcare Affordability, and under that work, to shed more light on the drivers of healthcare spending and to help you as policymakers understand what the options are to find the balance between spending growth and affordability. So there's more work to come. We're happy to share that with you at the time it becomes available.
Mr. Gielemeister and Ms. Mink, thank you for your testimony today. I do want to go back to the previous slide that you just had here. And the information you had on the left side, are you citing any information from the graphic that would have been contained in the report from Mercer in that information? And the reason I asked it is it appears on the data on this that it's almost 20-year-old data, and I'm just wondering if the department has anything that's a little more current, if you've requested follow-up and information on that, because 20 years is an awful long time in this industry with dynamics and healthcare and changes and costs and all of the above that you mentioned in your testimony today. Mr. Gielemeister?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I hesitated to show you this work, and I think I mostly did it to say absolutely the questions that you're asking are legitimate. They can be done. We've done that work in the past, but because it's so time and resource intensive, we have not done it in a while. But particularly with the APCD, which was established in Minnesota in 2009, we have better tools to do this work in the state. So can be done. we're happy to help.
So there really isn't any, Mr. Gildemeister, data other than what you're referencing here that's in a Mercer report or a combination of data and market conditions. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, not from Minnesota and not to my knowledge, but I think there is the kind of research that the team considers as part of the mandate review, sort of either on individual benefits or in considering premium increases from year to year. So, you know, we learn about the individual role that genetic therapies, for instance, play in rising health insurance premiums, but not globally sort of looking at mandates or looking at the cost of the premium share of the cost of standard benefits. That work, to my knowledge, has not been done in Minnesota. We have not looked to what extent it's been done elsewhere in the nation.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister and Ms. Mink. Members, questions for the testifier? Representative Elkins.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gildemeister, are there any kind of general price trend analysis studies that you've published that we could refer to?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, yes. Dr. Mink's team produces an annual analysis of spending trends in the commercial market. So there we look at essentially the trends in healthcare spending, and then we look to disaggregate them into their components. What portion of spending growth is driven by price increases? What portion is driven by changes in utilization? And then we tend to look at them at different types of services, hospital care, long-term care, et cetera. We're happy to make this available to the committee, the most recent version available to the committee. And we're working on the next version. I think the most recent analysis, Pam, is from 2022.
Ms. Mink.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The most recent version that's published is through 2022, but we are currently doing the analyses to update that with 2023. So each one, it's a 5-year, so we just move that forward each year. So hopefully, you know, within the next couple of months, we should have the one with 2023.
Representative Elkins, follow-up?
Just one, Mr. Chair. ERISA plans can't be required to contribute data to the all-payer claims database, but we can and should be encouraging them to do so. Are we actually seeing an increase in data coming from ERISA plans at this point?
Mr. Gildemeister, that question to you. Go ahead, sir.
I believe so. I fear that question is to me. Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins.
So make sure you get the right testifier, that's all.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Elkins, it's a really good and tough question and a tricky question to answer.
Maybe it was to go to Ms. Mink. I'm not sure.
Actually, yes. She could answer it probably more fluently than I can. I'll give it a try, though. It's a difficult question for us to answer in Minnesota because, unlike other states, we don't have a clear understanding of which TPA carry which third-party administrators do broker services for which employers. So that's not public information to our understanding. So we can't go. We would have to go individually to 3M and Best Buy and Target and ask them, okay, who's your broker? Are they submitting the data? Can we be of help? I would add to that clunky answer a few more thoughts. The inclusion of data from large employers in Minnesota, whether or not they are national employers, in the APCD is of self-interest to them. Why is that? It is because the APCD, our analysis, and their ability to perhaps request the data under new law passed a few years ago could really inform their benefit plan design around which hospitals to contract with, what services are standard, what is the prevalence of certain conditions, to what extent are GLP-1 drugs delivering benefits to patients, to enrollees. So these questions, I think, for employers with tens of thousands of employees are, they could be about real money because they represent potential savings or investments into the labor force. Because of the arm's length distance between us and employers, and certainly the lack of public information on that relationship, we don't know. We have at times talked to individual employers to make the case and work on and request what kind of analysis would be of value and interest to them. It's an ongoing journey. With regard to your very specific question, Representative Elkins, we don't know yet to what extent employers are responding to the opportunity, but we are also still in the process of making them aware of the opportunity to either direct their broker, Blue Cross Health Partners Medica, to submit the data on their behalf, or to submit the data directly to MDH, perhaps in exchange for really targeted analysis that can benefit them. I would expect, Representative Elkins, that we know more in 2025.
Representative Elkins, quick follow-up.
Yeah, this more of a comment than a question here, but ERISA plan employer sponsors have a fiduciary responsibility now to their plan members, and they have a right to obtain copies of the data about their employees, but doing it themselves is a very expensive, arduous process. Having their plan administrator contribute their data to the All-Payor Claims Database would actually be a cost-effective way for employers to be able to access and analyze the data about their own plans to ensure that they're meeting their fiduciary responsibilities. And that's why this particular issue is so important to me.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And that concludes the member questions that we have for Mr. Gillemeister and Ms. Mink. Thank you. If you can just hang tight in case there are other follow-up questions. Appreciate your time and your testimony today. The next testifier today is Barbara Cox from Health Partners. Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I feel like you all maybe need a little break, but here goes. Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Cox. I'm here representing Health Partners, and just a little bit about Health Partners because some of the committee members are new. We have a unique perspective because we are a health plan, insuring 1.8 million members. We are a medical and dental care system, treating more than 1.3 million medical and dental patients. And the other part of our organization that does relate to our work on policy is we have a significant research and medical education system. And if you are dying to know what this looks like in your district, how many of our members or patients, I've got that information for you. All right, well, we really appreciate the committee's interest on the topic of health insurance benefits, mandates, and their impact on affordability. And I think that Matt is going to speak to some more specifics to the cost, and I'm going to talk to a little bit more context. So hopefully that's helpful. We know from our sales, from our consumers, from the groups that we insure that affordability is a really key concern for consumers and employers. So at the outset, because a lot of the mandates that are considered in this committee are really important to the patients that they serve, I want to stress that my testimony isn't about any specific mandates, but just to the cumulative impact on consumers' ability to afford health care. There have been 17 coverage mandates that have been introduced this session to date, and there are 13 new benefit mandates that took effect on January 1st of this year. In each of the preceding years, new mandates were also enacted, and each of these mandates increases the cost of premiums to patients. So here's some sobering statistics to show how these state impacts fit into a national perspective. The National Consulting Group, PwC, found that in 2025, this year, medical cost growth will grow to the highest level in 13 years. So that, you know, precedes the pandemic. And here in Minnesota, I know you've got a lot of information in your packet, but I do hope that you will look at the Star Tribune article that talks about carriers in the individual and small group markets had to raise rates this year 9% to 15%. So that's before any new costs from proposed taxes that are being considered this year or any new mandates are added. Some of the unintended consequences that come from premium increases are the steady decline of that insurance market that is state regulated. You know, MDH presented some great information just now. They have some additional charts in their chart book that show the decline of the small group market. We know that some of that decline comes from groups that are in the state-regulated, fully insured market, and I know this stuff is complicated, where all the taxes and assessments and benefits apply. So those groups, in order to make care more affordable for their employees, will move to self-insured, where the taxes and the benefits and the assessments don't apply. Of course, people in the individual market, when we talk about reinsurance, don't have that choice. They're in that that state-regulated market. Another unintended consequence of increased cost is that when there are really, really high premiums and sticker shock, consumers increasingly purchase high deductible plans. And I think that one of the key concerns I always hear from legislators is we don't like high deductible plans. There was a debate last year about medical debt. We're also a care system, so we're very sensitive to that issue. Well, the reason that people buy high deductible plans is because that's all they can afford. And if you go on the Mincher website, if you haven't done that before, I know the chair has, it's really sobering what those deductibles are, and that's again because the cost is so high. Mrs. Satala from Commerce noted in her remarks that, you know, there is this possibility of downstream savings from benefits, but I just want to note that if coverage is so expensive that you can't buy coverage in the first place, you will never benefit from those mandated benefits that may end up, you know, with some savings. And that's the most serious consequence of steep premium increases, is that, you know, Minnesota, a state that has traditionally really low uninsured rate, that our uninsured rate would grow because people just can't afford coverage. And we are a care system as well as a health plan, as I noted. Our hospitals are really full. And so when people don't have coverage and they end up seeking care in the emergency room, that is not only, you know, the most expensive place for them to seek care, but also probably not the best place for them to seek care. I just want to state, we understand that this is really hard. Policymakers have a lot to balance, and, you know, these are trade-offs. But we are working really hard in our system to keep care and coverage affordable, and we hope that affordability is also a goal of the legislature this year. Affordability is access. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cox. And before we go to member questions, if there are any, I'm going to also ask Matt Schaefer from Medica to provide some feedback from their perspective as well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schaefer. If you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name's Matt Schaefer, Senior Director of Government Relations for Medica. We are a Minnesota-based nonprofit health plan, and we have about 1.5 million members across all 50 states. That's more of a reflection of your evolving workforce, that there's just more and more people working all over the country. We have about one of those 1.5 million, about half of those are here in Minnesota. About 35,000 of those are in the individual market as of 1/1/25. About 397,000 of our members get their coverage through employer-sponsored coverage here in the state, and a little fewer than half of those are purchasing a product that would be subject to a mandate that's passed in this building. Much like the other numbers you've heard today have indicated, the interest in self-insured products has continued to increase steadily. And of course, our workforce has changed as well. There's more people who are, companies are expanding. You have more folks who want to work remotely in places where you don't have polar vortexes. And so that's a dynamic that we have to adapt to. So there are other dynamics taking place. When we look at our members, we have teachers, we've got cops, healthcare providers, blue-collar, white-collar workers, tire shops, hair salons, and if they find out I work for Medica, they'll let me know that they're a member. In previous testimony, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans aggregated the mandate impact on premiums for all the nonprofit health plans over the last couple years, and the average came out to about $15 to $25 per member per month, or about a 5% premium increase over just this last round. And that would reflect our experience as well. A couple other dynamics that the committee might want to be aware of that also took place in that time frame, as folks know, during the pandemic, we did see a decrease in care. Folks were asked to stay home, and they did. What happened in those couple of years after was they came back, and we found they put off surgeries. If they had a chronic condition, those got worse. Costs naturally went up significantly. So that's been taking place. You add the mandates, and you also add the taxes, and unfortunately what that meant for our members was they were seeing some pretty significant increases. And for our employers in particular, there is not a process to defray the cost, and so for them they end up bearing the brunt of that. I'll leave the committee with just two points as we look at that. Is there was a lot of there was some good discussion about the mandate review process, and we do like that because going through the exercise of responding to the request for information allows us to have a little bit of predictability. Okay, what's this going to cost? When it comes to mandates that involve drugs, that's what keeps us up at night because anytime, and Minnesota is certainly not the only state passing laws that do this, but whenever you give the pharmaceutical industry or anyone who has the ability to mark up an already expensive drug more bargaining power, they're going to use it. And so even if we're able to give a per member per month cost for something in the first year, first couple of years, it's going to be a challenge to determine what's going to happen with that in the long run. And as folks are aware, drugs are already expensive and they're not getting cheaper. The other point, and if you'll indulge me, I'll give an anecdote I do worry about when it comes to our smaller employers. As a carrier, sometimes we're asked to participate in forums, and I'd like to talk about a forum we had in western Wisconsin this last summer because we've got quite a few members. And we have employers on both sides of the river, and we're asked, I did the health benefits piece, and then we had an employment law lawyer giving his piece. And the point is to illustrate that it's bigger than just health benefits that our small employers are running into. I hope Mr. Graves doesn't mind me stealing some of this thunder. They're also dealing with other employer requirements. They're dealing with new reporting requirements. There might be new taxes. And so as we gave our presentation, as what usually happens in these forums is you end up with a few people coming over who didn't want to ask their question in public. I heard the employment lawyer getting questions about their permitting process. I was getting healthcare once. I walked away from that discussion. It wouldn't be surprising at all if some of those Wisconsin employers were talking to their two or three people that work here and saying, hey, I love you. I want to keep you. Any chance you want to sell your house in Woodbury and come over to Hudson? I do appreciate the time to speak and are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Ms. Cox and Mr. Schaefer, thank you for your testimony today. I do not know of any member questions. So appreciate your time. Thank you. And Mr. Bentley Graves is our next testifier, followed by our final testifier today, Matt Flanders. So, Mr. Bentley, Mr. Graves, welcome to the committee. We'll go ahead and have you share your thoughts here this morning. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I can't see these screens, so hopefully this is going to work. You see that? All right, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We've had a couple of opportunities already this session to talk to you all about the impact of mandates and the cost imperative that presents to our members and their employees, and appreciate the opportunity to just hit a couple additional points here today in addition to the ground that was covered by all the testifiers beforehand. This is just a quick snapshot of us as a chamber, of our membership. Our statewide membership breaks down between Metro and Greater Minnesota. We have members that represent about every industry in Minnesota. And a piece that's not on here is about 80% of our members have 100 employees or less, or small, mid-sized employers. This is a different look at some of the data that was already presented, but this is also from MDH. This is kind of a snapshot of what health coverage looks like in Minnesota for about the last 10 years. I circled and read the fully insured segment of the market because that is where the lion's share of our members buy coverage for themselves and their employees. And just as, again, as another key, I know we've been over this probably a couple times today, but the fully insured market is a state-regulated market comprised of the individual, small group, large group, and the self-insured market is a federally regulated market that's ERISA exempted. But one of the questions that you had, Mr. Chair, earlier is what is kind of the trend in coverage in Minnesota? And you can see that on this chart that, you know, private coverage over the last 10 years has dipped and public coverage has increased. And that has meant fewer lives covered in the fully insured market. And, you know, that is a concern for us and our members. This is just another slide that kind of details the segments of the fully insured market, the large group, the small group, the individual, and the percentages represented by each. So as I said, the majority of our members are in the state-regulated fully insured market. About 70% of our members do offer coverage to their employees. Three-quarters of those do so through the state-regulated market. About a quarter self-insure under federal rules. This information is from an annual survey that we do of our members and our members every year, but with regard to our members, over a third say that if healthcare costs continue to increase at their current rate, they're going to have to either pass costs on to their employees. Another quarter said that they'll have to reduce the level of coverage provided, and one in 10 say, you know, they will be forced to drop coverage altogether, which is a scenario that we certainly want to avoid, and most employers do as well. But many have already had to make that choice. You see the last bullet point here. Those members of ours that do not currently offer insurance tell us, one in five of them tell us that they don't currently offer coverage because prohibitive cost increases force them to drop the coverage that they have. And this just kind of, you know, sits on top of a few of the cost trends that we've seen. There, as you heard from the testifiers earlier, there are a lot of ways to measure cost, but these are a few data points that I think just in fairly easy terms indicate that, you know, there are some cost and affordability concerns here in Minnesota. We have the ninth highest family premium for employer-sponsored insurance. We have the 13th highest individual premium for employer-sponsored insurance. And since 2017, Minnesota has reported among the highest median healthcare spending by families in the country. And we see these cost pressures materialize, I think, in some sense in those markets. You know, just over the last 10 years, we've seen 5,000 fewer groups covered in the small group market. So that's over 5,000 small employers that are no longer offering coverage to their employees in that market. Maybe they grew into the large group market, but that market has shrunk as well. Maybe, as was mentioned earlier, maybe they moved on to self-insure. But ultimately, I think there's much here to be concerned about, and I think much that underscores the backdrop of the large concern around healthcare costs. And that brings us to the conversation today. You know, I think it's always important for the legislature to kind of center its thinking around healthcare costs around those places where it directly controls healthcare costs, and those are state-regulated mandates, the healthcare and insurance taxes that the state places on insurance, and then finally, the significant underpayment of doctors and hospitals by public programs, which just pushes more costs onto commercial payers. But on this piece of mandates, this is the list that CMS has on file for Minnesota's state mandates. We have the second longest list in the country. You don't have to read all this. I know it's very small, but I think just for an illustration, it's a lot. This is before the last couple of years where we added a number more. It says here, you know, we added another 14 mandates over the last biennium, and we've covered that as well. But just to kind of put, a fine point on the cost considerations of this, in 2025, small group premiums increased by as much as 15%. And carrier filings and identified increased mandates as a component of that, which is, again, one of the reasons why we are often up here talking about the cost considerations of these mandates. Hopefully, over the last few years, we've had the new mandate review process in place. This is just a screenshot of the reports that were done for this year. And this last final screen is just a summary of what has been passed as far as new mandates over the last couple of years. It takes the per member per month estimates that were provided in those reports and multiplies out over the entire market to give everybody some sense of what the full impact costs of these mandates are. And then finally leads us to the conversation that was started last week around what we think is a solution to this very vexing problem for legislation, that is passing legislation like Representative Perryman and Hewitt's legislation, House File 400, that would have the state pay for the cost of all new mandates in all state-regulated market segments, and give the legislature the ability to meet the demands that come before it for new and added benefits without increasing the cost of coverage, which, you know, as I said in the previous slides, is is becoming a real problem for employers and employees around the state. So I know we're pressed for time, Mr. Chair. With that, I will be happy to answer questions. But thank you again very much for the opportunity to testify and to engage in this dialogue with the committee. We greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Mr. Graves, thank you for being here with us today. I do not have any member questions at this time. And our final testifier today is Matt Flanders. If he would come forward, we'll give you about 4 or 5 minutes to go ahead and share your thoughts with us today as well before the committee concludes its business. Welcome, and if you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Flanders, and I promise I'll keep it far less than 5 minutes. I have just a few thoughts today. The Legislative and Policy Director at Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We are a national nonprofit health policy organization based right here in St. Paul. Our mission is to protect patient and doctor freedom, and we are grateful to be here to share how healthcare mandates increase the cost of coverage for Minnesotans and to offer a few possible solutions. According to data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, total U.S. health spending adjusted for inflation was $2.1 trillion in the year 2000. In 2020, national health spending was $4.6 trillion. Nationally, adjusted for inflation, health insurance costs for employer-sponsored family coverage increased from roughly $12,000 per year in 2000 to $24,000 in 2023. Even with this adjustment for inflation, the cost of health insurance for the average family has doubled over the last two decades, becoming unaffordable for many. Additionally, over the last 20 years, employers are paying a larger share of health insurance premiums, about 5% higher, which effectively reduces what the employee could be receiving in wages. Reasons for such dramatic increases in premiums include the passage of the ACA, requiring insurers to insure uninsurable conditions, the ACA's ban on the sale of catastrophic coverage to people over the age of 29, and coverage mandates, including state compliance with the ACA's essential health benefits. According to the Washington Policy Center, each mandate placed on health insurers increases premiums by about 0.5% to 2.5%, depending on the mandate. When you consider the dozens of state and federal mandates, this adds up to a substantial part of the cost of coverage. Over the last few years, including this year, Minnesota legislators have introduced dozens of bills related to coverage mandates. Yet not every patient or consumer is the same. Each is unique with different health needs, financial situations, and more. Each person also should have the freedom to make their own decisions based on weighing risks and benefits. We would encourage this committee to add flexibility, freedom, and choices rather than costly mandates that are ultimately passed on to Minnesotans in higher premiums and, for many Minnesotans, lower take-home pay. Possible solutions include legislation that would allow companies to offer mandate-free policies or policies with fewer mandates. Another option is to recognize the state's right to pass a state law allowing the sale of catastrophic coverage for all ages, or to pass a version of the Farm Bureau coverage laws that have been passed in 7 other states. So I appreciate your time, appreciate this committee's attention to this very important issue for Minnesotans, and I'm happy if anyone has any questions.
Mr. Flanders, thank you for your question. I did not see any member questions at this time. I'm going to step back to one other item. Mr. Graves, if you could provide your PowerPoint presentation for the members of the committee, that would be helpful, since we did not have a hard copy of that. Members, that concludes our conversation today for mandates. I appreciate the questions, and I appreciate your willingness to work on this. This is an issue that everyone around this table has talked about, increase in premiums, and so we're looking at all the different drivers on here. With that, before we adjourn here this morning, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to, two quick things. One is I just wanted to say quickly that I appreciate the conversation today. Rising cost of healthcare is a great concern to all of us who are here. I don't know anyone at the legislature who is here, regardless of the body of work that they do, that they're also not thinking about the rising cost of healthcare. And that we're all here trying to solve a problem that sits at the intersection of so many of the systems that create the disparities in these health outcomes that, you know, we are looking at what happens to people when they are housing insecure, and we know that they are people who are housing insecure the most have adverse outcome in their health. that we the cost of education is so great these days that people are unable to actually have, even within the education they need, to be able to get secure jobs that pay well and jobs that provide them the benefits they need so that they can afford the life that they want. And we're also a part of this food system that really separates people from their food source. And, you know, and the list goes on, that the infrastructures that we choose to create do not promote physical mobility. And all of this impacts people's health. And how do we look at all of the ways in which not just what we're trying to do here in health and trying to reduce costs, but when we are looking at all of the pieces of the work that we do here at the state of Minnesota, how do all of these pieces contribute to this? And though struggling with this, I also can't see a system in which we don't require mandates about my own self and my health. I'm a chronic condition I've managed since I was 17 years old. And I can't, if I were to add up all of the money which I have paid out of pocket for healthcare coverage that has not been covered, and I think about the immense amount of privilege that I have in economic privilege, extremely educated person. I have no language barriers. I have all of the privileges of this life, and yet what I've paid out of pocket, I think that should be covered, right? When I'm sitting in an exam room because I felt the breast in my lump and I'm sitting there and they're asking me if I want a 3D or if I want a traditional mammogram, and I have no idea. And I'm asking, well, how do I find out if this is covered as I'm sitting in this room and nobody can tell me? And I opt to go ahead and do the 3D hoping that that gets covered. And fortunately, it was covered under my plan, but there was a lump in my breast. And I did have to go through years of monitoring. And I think about the fact that I've paid all of this money out of pocket. I've always been insured because that was really important to me. I've never paid for a high deductible plan because I knew the potential of what could happen to me if I didn't. And yet I have paid all of this money into a system where I've benefited maybe very little from that because I was able to maintain myself in a way through having a food system that really connects me to my food, being housing secure, being able to use my education in a way that allowed me to maintain my health. And I think about the cost it was to me, and I know that the average Minnesotan could never have done that, could never have afforded it, would never have had the privilege to look for some of the resources that I did. And so we are looking at a very complex system here of how do we reduce healthcare costs, which would require for us to actually think about that in every decision we make in all other committees that we are in, but also knowing that mandates are something that unless we as healthcare plans figure out how to do this together, that these mandates are going to continue to come, and they are absolutely necessary, because why pay for plans that cost me all this money and then not even be able to know if something that impacts my health is going to be covered? And so I know that we are all here because we have the will to fix that, and I felt like it just was really important for me to say that this is not a problem just to be solved in commerce or in health, but in every committee we all sit on. And if there's the will for us to fix this situation, then we have to really think about not solving this problem in a silo. So I just wanted to say that it was really important for me to really put that out there. And I should just go back and put down how much I've paid in out-of-pocket costs, because I think I've paid through, since I was 17, I'm 52 now, hundreds of thousands of dollars out-of-pocket so that I don't go into kidney failure, so that I save the state and taxpayers millions of dollars in dialysis and transplant and all of that. And so, I'm kind of feeling like I'm in a position where maybe I can stand a little bit on my high horse and ask for people to do better. And so I just thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair, for sharing that. And I would just ask as this is probably this is our last hearing for this week, maybe to a quick preview of next week for the committee and for the team.
I'm sorry, what was the last last item?
Preview for everyone.
Well, that's a fabulous question, and I want to just make sure that that's the question I heard, so I didn't answer the wrong question. My answer is stay tuned. We will have details soon. And if there is no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.